Hello there, I'm Chuck Todd. I just stepped off the Meet the Press set. I interviewed New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu today. He's being certainly a potential presidential candidate in a growing Republican field, with former President Trump clearly now as the one of the two frontrunners, along with the Florida governor. And at the top of the show, I had a joint interview with both leaders of the House Intelligence Committee, Chair Mike Turner, Vice Chair Jim Himes. And we, of course, talked about the security threats out of China, Russia, the latest theories around the origins of COVID, and those classified docs. I'm sitting here now with the former U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security and a veteran of the Justice Department as well, Mr. Jay Johnson, who was also on the show. Jay, good to see you.
Nice to be here, Chuck.
Look, you took the moderator chair away from me for a half a second, and I say this with love here and with admiration, but you wanted to make a point about the interview with the two intel folks, because I was shocked that they didn't see the documents. They didn't see the documents. They cannot tell us the difference. They don't know what they've seen. They couldn't. What was the briefing if it wasn't the documents?
That's a good question. And if you're going to go through the trouble of giving them a briefing on the substance of the documents, you may as well show them the documents, take them right back again. They're not allowed to make copies. So at least they're in a position to say, I've seen the documents, and the FBI, the intel community is in a position to say, yes, we have shared this with our congressional oversight.
I thought it was fascinating. I was wondering, boy, is the intel community not trusting Congress? And Mike Turner was quick to say, no, this is the FBI.
Correct.
And what did you make of that?
I mean, basically, it's a statement from the FBI, we don't trust you, because the intel communities, and I know this from personal experience, are made privy to all sorts of very, very sensitive things that go on. All sorts of classified programs are shared with Congress. And if you can't trust the intelligence oversight with something that is part of a pending investigation, that says a lot.
Well, it doesn't matter whether they trust it or not. I mean, you know, whether they like it or not, they have to let the legislative branch know.
I'm fairly confident that if the chair and ranking said, look, enough, go to a classified copy machine, make one copy of all of, and we're probably not talking about a lot of documents. This may just be one pouch of documents coming from all these different sources.
On the Trump stuff, I've heard it was sort of 150 documents, 700 pages long. So
okay,
it is a ream.
700 pages.
I think it is a ream. It's more than a ream.
It's a stack.
Yeah.
It's a stack. Right. It's thinner than any bill passed by Congress. How about
right.
that?
Fair enough.
And bring over one copy, put us in a skiff.
Yeah.
No staff. Let us read it, and then we'll give it right back to you. How is the legislative branch supposed to conduct its job of oversight and conduct the damage assessment?
So it's interesting watching the FBI conduct itself. I get the sense, and this happens sometimes, where in an effort to be apolitical, you make decisions that come across as political. And it feels as if the FBI is so worried about perception that they have almost allowed it to cloud their sort of institutional judgment.
I don't know if I'd go that far, Chuck. I do know from having to be in the middle of these kinds of disputes that for the FBI, for the prosecutors, the investigation is paramount. That's like, to them, the most important thing, protecting the integrity of their investigation. And they're not keen on the role of Congress in its legislative oversight prerogatives. They're just not. They figure, well, you can wait till later. But, you know, Congress has a job. And I've had to make the argument when I was at the Defense Department, we have to protect the integrity of the potential prosecution. We can't give this to you. That works really only to a point. When somebody says to you, I'm the chair of the House Intel Committee. I'm trusted with all kinds of highly sensitive information. You can show me this. It's kind of difficult to come back from.
Besides being Homeland Security Secretary, you were chief counsel at the Pentagon, which means you deal with classified information all the time.
Yes.
It is pretty clear now that there is a growing movement. As a journalist, I'm happy about this, that there's a growing movement led by Bill Burns to show and tell our work in the intel community more often than not.
Yes.
And do this. Looking back, do you wish we had had that policy over the last 25 years? Would the Intel community in general be more respected if we did?
Well, the reality is, as everybody knows, it is way easier to classify something than it is to declassify something. I could be sitting at my desk in the Pentagon creating a document, and down at the bottom I put classified by Jay Johnson, declassify on March 5, 2088.
And you had that power?
Yes, as an original classification authority. Yes. Yeah. And to declassify something requires a multi-agency review to make sure everybody's equities are protected, to make sure sources and methods are protected. I used to see things on the classified email system, like calendar, the calendars. People keep their calendars.
Well, there's been an implication that that might be what Biden had. Notes on a calendar, and that might be what Pence had. Notes on a schedule. We don't know. None of us know what it is.
Can't begin
there's
to
been some
right?
leaks at that because schedules were classified, weren't they?
Right. I can't begin to speculate. I do know that there is far more classified in our government that after a certain point really doesn't need to be classified anymore. Mm-hmm. And it is difficult to unwind that process. What's interesting is when you live in the classified world and you come on Meet the Press or do any other public statement or public commentary, you've got to keep neatly in your head a bifurcation between what's classified and what's not. Some people are better at that than others. You have to ask yourself, I mean, when I was in office and I was heavily involved in something that was classified and I was going to say something public, I'd have to have very clear in my mind what's not classified and what is classified.
And what happens when something that you know via classified, but it's leaked by somebody else and we're reporting it? Tell us about this. So it's not been declassified, but it puts you in you've been in that position.
That's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah.
Remember WikiLeaks?
Yeah.
WikiLeaks is all over the New York Times. And somebody sends me on the unclass email system a link to the story that contains classified information. Have we just compromised the email system? The obligation to keep things classified continues long after you leave office. So in the panel discussion we just had, if the four of you started talking about some highly classified program that I learned about when I was in office.
That if you learned about it via classified material. If you learned about it the way we learned about it, you could talk about it, right?
Yes. Yeah. If I didn't know anything about it while I was in government, but I knew something about it while I was in government, now it's out in the open in the New York Times because David Sanger or somebody else reports on it.
Right.
I still can't talk about it.
Yeah. Let me pivot to your old job. And I'm more curious about I'm very alarmed by what's happening in the Mexican government and what's happening in Mexico's democracy. AMLO wants to mess around with we actually criticized him very gently, and he got really upset about this week. The State Department criticized because they want to get rid of an electoral commission that essentially helped provide. I mean, it was barely a democracy for about 70 years. And then Mexico over the last 30 has been a fairly robust, gone back and forth, had some new political parties popped up. Is AMLO an ally in going after the cartels or not?
So that's a good question. cartels in Mexico are very powerful.
Are they as powerful as the Colombian cartels were of the 80s?
Could be. They are very powerful at the state government level in Mexico in certain states. To be blunt, there are just certain state-level governments in Mexico that you absolutely cannot trust because the cartels are so
– they either bought them off or scared them by killing them off, right?
I mean, one or the other, yeah. Correct. Yeah. There are whole regions of Mexico that are basically controlled by the cartels, and I don't want to oversimplify that. When I was in office, I dealt with President Enrique Peña Nieto, and I used to deal with him personally. Interestingly, the Secretary of Homeland Security to Mexico and to some extent Canada is regarded by them as our Secretary of State because you have to deal with those governments on so many different facets. So I would deal with multiple members of the Mexican government cabinet. In Mexico, immigration is a tough issue. In many places in Mexico, it's regarded as a human right to travel through Mexico and head north. I think with the Trump administration, AMLO's attitude was just do what they say and get them off my back. I think it's a little more nuanced now. On day one of his administration, President Biden ended MPP, the Migration Protection Protocols, before there was even a Secretary of Homeland Security, mm-hmm. in part because that's something the Mexican government really wanted.
Right.
And now with the southern border, we're having to scramble and try to control the numbers. But a lot of that depends upon the full cooperation and participation of the Mexican government. Right. One of the things we did in 2014 to deal with the spike then was to get the Mexican government to do more on their southern border mm-hmm. with Central America. And they said, we'll do that. We'll help you. Just please don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. Please don't say a lot about it.
Right.
And that border, as I recall, is only like 300 miles long mm-hmm. as opposed to our 1900 sure. mile border with Mexico. And so we depend very much on the Mexican government to help us on that issue.
If you were, let's talk about the border itself. Is the bigger challenge the ports of entry or the non-ports of entry parts of the border?
When it comes to people, migrants, the bigger challenge is the land border.
Okay.
And also migrants who show up at the bridges to claim asylum.
Right.
When it comes to narcotics.
Yeah, fentanyl and that sort of thing.
It's the ports. It's stuff.
That's what I keep hearing. Like, our real issue isn't like we need a wall over the whole border. We need to be smarter at the ports, right?
When it comes to drugs, guns, merchandise, it's the ports. We have to be smarter, better technology at ports of entry. Correct. You don't have large, vast shipments of things crossing the desert over land borders. It's at the ports.
So it's my understanding that this is a two-way problem. And the way
yes.
to, meaning we're a gun exporter and yes. a fentanyl importer.
The Mexicans used to say to me, yeah. well, we'll help you with the migrants flowing north if you'll help us with the guns flowing south.
Right. It's my understanding ATF's going to actually have an office now in Colombia.
That's
as a South American headquarters, a Latin American headquarters, to deal with this gun running issue.
DHS probably ought to have space in that office.
You think so too?
Yes.
Is there a smarter way? Should ATF have been part of DHS?
Chuck, I'm going to say this in a flash of candor.
Everything about you is candor. I actually believe that, and I want people to believe that. I do believe
flash
that.
Of candor.
I think you're careful, but I always believe
DHS you. Was created. It was a political compromise. In some respects, we went too far. In other respects, we didn't go far enough.
Right.
The thinking in 2002 was that terrorism, which was the motivating principle for the creation of this department, mm-hmm. was an extraterritorial threat from beyond our borders. And if you put in one cabinet-level department, the regulation of all the different ways somebody could enter our country, land, sea, and air, mm-hmm. you've effectively dealt with terrorism.
Right? Okay.
Because you've kept the terrorist out. That model is now outdated, I say on our 20th anniversary. It's outdated because the principal terrorism threat to our nation is now domestic-based. And there are not a whole lot of DHS cops running around in the interior of our country, contrary to what you might see on TV. Mm-hmm. if I were king, and I'm not king, and I could just decree a realignment of government, and this will never happen, I'd create one Department of Public Safety
yeah.
or Ministry of the Interior, whatever you want to call it, put every single federal law enforcement agency, including aviation security, into this one department, leave the lawyers in the Department of
Justice.
FBI too. The mm-hmm. FBI would fight it tooth and nail yes, because they've got a fair degree of autonomy in the Department of Justice.
Right.
Put them all in one big cabinet department, deconflict all their missions, have one intelligence and analysis directorate to support them,
yeah.
And have one cabinet level official who oversees all of it, which is what they have in many other countries, including countries as large as China.
Yeah.
So, it makes too much sense, which is why it would never happen.
Because you hear this all the time, the ATF and the Homeland Security folks run into each other all the time.
And ATF, Homeland Security, FBI, yeah. Homeland Security Investigations,
yes.
DEA.
HSI, I hear the most complaints about from my friends at ATF.
HSI is the scrappy little law enforcement agency that always punches above its weight.
Spoken by a former Department of Homeland Security Secretary.
Thank you.
Before I let you go, you host a weekly show that features your favorite jazz musicians. Is that fair to say?
Classic R&B.
Classic R&B.
Classic R&B.
Let me ask you this. In 200 years, they may have to only be able to pick one example of R&B. You know, when we go along, it's like there are a million composers. There were a lot of composers during the era of Mozart and Beethoven. We basically decided Mozart and Beethoven, that'll tell you what classical music is. In 200 years, in the world of R&B, who's the one or two people that will be? This is the best example. Who will that be? Who should it be? Who should be the icon 200 years from now on R&B?
Well, that's easy. The Queen of Soul and the Godfather of Soul, Aretha Franklin and James Brown.
That's a great answer.
If you're going to reduce me to two people.
Yeah, and the thing is, I say this, history does reduce it. I mean, look what we did to Mozart and Beethoven. Yes. We talk about anybody else?
Right.
Right.
And in my view, I always bristle at the term oldies. It's not oldies. This is the golden era of R&B. And you hear, stuff being reproduced, recreated all the time today from the golden era.
A lot of sampling. A lot of today's music samples a lot of stuff from the quote-unquote golden era.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm going to say this for the record. Chuck, one day I would love to have you on my show.
I would love to do that. I was a classically trained musician.
My last guest was Ambassador Andrew Young.
Oh, yeah. And?
On MLK weekend.
And? What was his musician? What was his musical instrument?
He loved everything. But he's 91 years old.
Yeah.
We talked about Dr. King. Interestingly, Martin Luther King got a C in public speaking at Morehouse College.
And why was that?
That's good. I don't know.
Who's tough that grader? Professor?
Tough
that
grader?
A tough grader? Was there a bell curve?
I don't know.
Who got the A? That's what we really need to know. Who is it that got the A?
That's a good question. But he said one other very interesting thing. If I could belabor this.
Please.
He said, I asked him, do you think that in April 1968, Martin Luther King knew he was going to die? And he said, yes, he planned on it. And he said, I have come to believe that in his last days, Dr. King knew he was going to die and wanted to be with the least of God's children when that happened, sanitation workers. He wanted to be, he didn't want to be in Washington or someplace else. He wanted to be with his people. Mm-hmm. And that's why his staff was upset that he went to Memphis for that march. He said, you've already been there. It's all organized. We're planning the Poor People's Campaign. And he said, no, I want to be with the sanitation workers.
So Andrew Young implied that just whatever it is, he had a sixth sense about what was coming.
Yes.
Well, when you think about the amount.
Well, he spoke about it the night before
he was
killed.
Think about the amount of death threats he'd probably been dealing with at that point. I don't want to say he became numb to it, but you do have to be like, he had to make a choice. I keep speaking out or I don't and hide.
Right.
And,
Yep.
There was no sense in hiding. Good to see you, Jay.
Good to see you.
All right. Thank you.